Of the survivable airline accidents between 1983 and 2000, only 56% of the passengers did survive. What was the deciding factor that led nearly half of them to be victims and allowed the other half to stay alive? Which group would you be in? Amanda Ripley addresses these questions using scientific data and true stories in her new book, The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why? It's published by Crown. And it is with great pleasure that I welcome Amanda Ripley to the show today. Hello.
Hi.
In researching this book, you experienced a simulated plane crash and also a burn tower. What's a burn tower?
It's basically a concrete building out behind the fire training academy in Kansas City. That's where I did it, that they fill with non-toxic smoke. And it's got all sorts of rooms and different floors, and there's old furniture in there. And you get an experience of what it's like to try to get out of a fire.
But didn't knowing that it was simulated really help you?
Of course. And so I also had a firefighter with me, which is nice, if you're going to be in a fire. I also had full firefighter gear on, which was fun. But it was my attempt was to sort of triangulate my way in this book. So I did the simulations, which were really interesting in different ways. And then I did a lot of work with scientists who studied the brain under extreme stress. And then the third prong was the stories of survivors. So between the three experiences, I'm hoping to get a glimpse.
Well, did your personal experiences help you get over your fears?
Yeah, you know, I found that after writing this book, I was less worried about everything, which was interesting. And I never thought of myself as particularly phobic, but you know, I covered a lot of disasters for Time magazine. I spent a lot of time with survivors. I did a lot of crime reporting.
You went to Katrina.
Right.
And where people had to really deal with a shocking disaster.
Yeah. And so I think no matter what, you do start to think about, you know, if you cover terrorism, you think about terrorism more than your average person. So I think this book, in a way, was it sort of allowed me to get a foothold in it all.
But don't people often fantasize about how they would react during a disaster?
Yes.
Perhaps more than they need to?
Yes, I think that's right. I think we all have these ideas. And, you know, it depends on what your particular anxiety is. But we have ideas in our head about what it might be like. And yet it's sort of not talked about, you know. So we worry a lot about things. There's a lot of time spent on TV media in particular worrying about things. But we don't actually know anything about our disaster personality.
Well, since more people die from heart attacks and strokes than they do from disasters, should we be worrying about that instead?
We should. We absolutely should. And I spend a lot of time in the book talking about how the brain assesses risk, because we have these great blind spots in our heads that aren't really well calibrated for modern risks.
Do you think people believe they're more prepared for survival than they actually are?
It depends on the person. I think men are in general. Men are much more likely to die in a large number of disasters because they are overconfident. Not all of them, but they're more likely to be overconfident. Let's put it that way.
Women are more likely when they know a disaster is going to happen to prepare for it?
Well, it depends. So they're more likely to evacuate when they're given an order to evacuate, especially if they have children. And that's why you see many more men die in hurricanes and floods. That and also because men have a higher tendency to drive through water, which is very dangerous even when it's a low-level water. So, you know, there's advantages and disadvantages, just like in life, depending on your gender and depending on the disaster.
You found that people exhibited the same behavior in response to different kinds of traumas. What was that behavior?
I was really surprised because at first I started out looking at research into the behavior in the World Trade Center. It's you know, so many thousands of people in this horrible situation, but it's also a really interesting laboratory for human behavior under stress. And then I started looking at other disasters like shipwrecks and tornadoes and earthquakes, and I was struck by how similar the behavior was. So that's really amazing. And yet it's not what you expect. So I broke it down into sort of three phases. And that those are ones you see over and over again, and they usually go in order, although not always. But the first one is usually a profound period of denial, where your brain becomes very creative in trying to come up with counter narratives for what you're experiencing, so that you think everything is fine.
So even, does that shut us down, really?
It slows you down. Mm-hmm. It slows you down, and it's a perfectly reasonable response because your brain identifies patterns all the time. That's how we get around, right? So you're assuming that it's never happened before, so it won't happen this time. Even when there's literally smoke in the room, people will laugh or make jokes.
But this is different from the experience I once had where I was in a car that flipped over. And I did experience that slow-mo that you get in the movies. Everything seemed to slow down, and I was watching it from a distance.
Yeah, that's so interesting. And that, again, is very common, the distortion of time. Usually it's slowing down for people, but sometimes it speeds up. And you're right, it depends on the urgency of the threat. So you may not go through all these phases, or you might go through them very quickly, depending on the urgency.
So if someone panics, is that actually better in some ways, because at least they're going to act?
Yeah, I mean, I've had aviation safety people say, I wish people would panic. They're joking. But the bigger problem is something called negative panic, where people literally shut down. And that's something even stronger than denial. They stop moving altogether.
But the basic three are what you call a survival arc.
Yeah, so denial is the first one. So we saw that people waited on average 6 minutes before beginning to evacuate from the Trade Center. 1,000 people took the time to shut down their computers, et cetera.
They just couldn't give up their BlackBerries or their email.
Yeah, well, it's an interesting the way the brain gets distracted by those things. And then the second one is deliberation, which is really interesting. People become very social in a disaster. So on average, people will check with 4 or 5 different sources before evacuating, before a hurricane.
Because they don't want to look like they're the jerk who's overreacting.
Right. Like if a fire alarm went off, you know, what would happen?
You'd escape, and I being a male, I'd be dying in the fire.
We would look at each other, and then we'd look at those people over there.
And
then
we'd see if they were reacting.
And we'd say, Bob, what do you think that's about? And then, you know, and it becomes very social very quickly, and you become very likely to try to stay with a group almost at all costs. We see this in mine disasters where people will really work hard to stay with their group, even if they don't believe that the decision being made about what to do is the best decision. Which leads to the third phase, which is the decisive moment is what I call it. But it's basically when you finally take action, or more likely, you shut down. You go into this sort of stupor, which is very common in all animals and is a good defense mechanism, except not so much in modern disasters.
It's genetic. We just automatically curl up in a ball and try to survive the dangerous situation?
Well, certainly the fear response is very primitive, and we understand it better than a lot of other emotions because it is so clearly evolved through animals and hasn't changed that much. There is clear evidence that animals in labs will, if you hold them down for a few seconds and they can't get out, they will immediately go into this stupor and stop moving. It almost looks like they're dead. And that is, of course, the strategy. So predators are less likely to eat an animal that looks to be sick or dead. And then you can snap them out of it if you know the tricks. I don't think people relate this to how human beings behave. And yet there's no reason it should be any different. And in fact, if you talk to people who see people under stress, from firefighters to flight attendants, even stockbrokers have seen this, or driver's ed instructors that I talk to, they will tell you stories about people freezing.
My guest is Amanda Ripley, who has written a book called The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. It is published by Crown. This is WNYC and WNYC.org. I'm Leonard Lopate. Does physical fitness play a role in survival? Does it help if we're more physically fit?
Yes, we know that from the Trade Center, for example, your fitness level influenced the chances that you would be injured and have trouble recovering afterwards. So just like in regular life, if you are more fit, you're less likely to feel physically and permanently the effects of extreme stress. You're less likely to have a heart attack, for example. You also move faster. This is a big problem in stairways, by the way, stairways that were designed for skyscrapers long ago. And even now, safety engineers know that they're too narrow. People sway back and forth when they go downstairs, and they take up a lot of space.
You say military research has shown that certain people are built or wired to respond well to life and death situations. So genetics are a factor as well?
Yeah, it's actually – there's some fascinating research that's been done into special forces soldiers because it was clear that they behaved differently under extreme duress. And so they began testing, literally looking at their blood and looking at their blood before they became special forces soldiers, and it was different.
But I would think that natural selection then would be a factor here.
Yeah, well, it's right.
I think my great ancestors survived. when others didn't. And so it's in my blood.
Yeah, but then again, we all survived. So it's complicated, and it certainly is interacting with your experiences in life.
You consulted neuroscientists and psychologists while you were researching this book. What's the latest research on this topic? You say this is better researched than many areas?
The fear response is better researched, but often the people studying this don't talk to each other. So it's very stovepiped, sort of like the government. So people who study airplane crashes don't talk to people who study, you know, hurricane behavior or wildfires or these kinds of things.
So, and they're all pretty much the same?
The behavior is similar. There's a lot to learn from these different things. And so we are just, you know, beginning, as you know, to scratch the surface of how the brain works. But it's endlessly interesting. And the good news is there's incredible room for improvement.
Well, this is not the moment to do a brain scan when your life is in danger. But that's how we're really going to find out how people react, isn't it?
Yeah, I mean, we already know that. Well, I did do a brain scan actually for the book. I did an MRI, and they figured out that people whose hippocampus, which is part of your brain that handles certain executive functions,
it's the part that helps us remember things.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, and it's very important in making decisions under extreme stress. And they found that Vietnam veterans who have developed post-traumatic stress disorder are more likely to have had smaller hippocampi before they went into combat, which is wild. So in other words, it's certainly not their fault that they have PTSD, but they were perhaps slightly more vulnerable, and that in combination with the experience left them far worse off than people who went through the same experience.
Now, all of this goes opposite to everything that I've always thought. I thought you're in the stressful situation, your adrenaline levels start rushing through your body, you know, there's adrenaline all over you, and you just respond. You become stronger than you ever were, you become quicker, you become more alert. Not true?
You are correct. I'm happy to say that you get certain bionic superpowers, definitely, when you're under extreme stress. But for each one you get, you lose another one that you normally have in regular life. So it's a trade-off. And so you might get incredible vision. This is very common. It might stay with you for months after the disaster. You might get incredible sense of hearing. Your brain will often turn on and shut off your senses in the middle of the disaster to help you focus. But at the same time, you might have a lot of trouble getting off your seatbelt or basic things that you normally are good at doing.
Well, it works both ways. One of the people you interviewed, Ella Zedeno, survived the first World Trade Center terror attacks in 1993. And during that event, she experienced temporary blindness. Is that a common reaction?
Your vision gets usually in most people, a majority of police officers actually in multiple studies who've been in shootings say they get tunnel vision where you lose your peripheral vision. It looks like you're looking out of a peephole or something. And then in some cases, you lose your vision altogether. And that's what happened to Elia. And she wasn't frightened. It was actually on 9/11, and she had made it out of the building and to the mezzanine. And she saw bodies on the ground and was quite shocked. It was like her brain hadn't accepted that this was actually happening until this moment. And then she lost her vision altogether. It's very interesting.
How long before it was restored?
It was interesting. Somebody immediately, a stranger, grabbed her by the elbow because she was just standing there and said, "Come on, we're getting out of here," and walked her away from the scene. And then she heard a rumbling sound, which was the first tower collapsing, and her vision came right back right when she needed it, and she ran into another building.
But it almost sounds like a form of denial. It's like the amnesia that some people have if they've been through a traumatic situation.
Yeah, and denial is actually a very effective coping device. I mean, and you see it throughout the book, dissociation, where people, like you were saying, where you kind of feel like you see yourself from a distance. It works really well. I mean, it only doesn't work well when it is too profound and extreme in its effects.
Another example is Clay Violent, is it?
Mm-hmm.
He survived the shootings at Virginia Tech University, and he experienced a type of temporary paralysis. That's what we were talking about earlier, when people just curl up into a ball and make believe that nothing's happening.
Yeah, he'd never been in any situation like this, and this shooter comes into the classroom, and his immediate response, and it was he had great conviction about it at the time. There was no deliberation. He just immediately went into this playing dead mode. And he talked about it later and was really confused by it. But and who knows? But it is true that he did not get shot and everyone else in the room did, and it's hard to say why.
Isn't denial counterintuitive? How does it fit in with evolution?
Well, if you think about it, what your brain is trying to do is to say, how does this fit into the scripts that are in my database? How do I respond to this quickly? And if you've never been in this situation or never even thought about what you would do, then you're more likely to go into denial because it doesn't. There is no script in your head.
Does it matter whether you're alone or whether you're in a group? And I want to get to that group again in a little while.
It matters a great deal. You're almost never alone in a disaster, and the people you live and work with will dramatically influence what happens to you.
We'll take a little break, and when we come back, we'll talk about that and why some people help and others don't, and why there are stampedes. With my guest, Amanda Ripley, who's written a book called The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. It's published by Crown. We're back with Amanda Ripley, who is a senior writer for Time magazine, and she has been extensively involved in the magazine's Person of the Year cover stories. Now writes about homeland security and risk in Washington, D.C., and she's written a book about risk called The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why, published by Crown. Was covering disaster stories like Hurricane Katrina what got you thinking about doing this book?
Yeah. In every case, I found that it was regular people, the people who'd gotten out, who had the most compelling and also useful stories to tell. And yet you almost never heard about regular people when you went to, you know, Homeland Security conferences or congressional committee hearings. So we spent all this money on Homeland Security since 9/11. But we don't think about the people who are always first on the scene, you know, which is regular people.
Well, let's talk about them. So you said that most disasters occur when there are lots of people around together. Did you find that they tend to act selfishly or selflessly?
Generally, people are much calmer and more obedient than we expect. So the kind of hysterical panic that we think is going to happen is very unusual. Certain conditions have to be present for that to really take place in most cases.
It's mostly in the movies, actually.
Yeah, exactly.
Well, do people tend to act better when there are family members or close friends around? Or does it matter? Will they also show altruism for strangers?
Generally, an instant camaraderie springs up between strangers on a train or in a building. And there have been people who have looked at this in all different situations, and it doesn't seem to matter. Although it is true that in, say, airplane crashes, people will go to extraordinary lengths to get to their loved ones before they evacuate. So if they're in different seats or whatever, they will move differently than we might expect.
And you talk about this not only occurring with humans. We've seen it in chimpanzees.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I get a little nervous about some of the animal comparisons in the book because I don't want to suggest that people are, you know, like animals, but chimps are.
But we are animals.
But we are. It's true. I'm glad I'm in a safe place here. I can do that. And but chimpanzees become very social when they're under threat. They form groups. They might touch each other sort of affectionately. And you think about it, it's because they're scarier to the predator or whoever they're dealing with.
So they start practicing what's called groupthink?
Yes. So the hierarchy that existed before the threat becomes even more important. So whoever the alpha male is or the leader or, you know, in a most people's situation, if you're in a theater, for example, the employee at the theater will become very important and people will listen to that person.
Well, sometimes people just offer themselves as the leader and sometimes they're followed. Sometimes the response is, who the heck is he?
Yeah, there seem to be certain characteristics of leaders who get a lot of followers under extreme stress. And one is that they usually have a deputy, and another one is that they usually are open to changing their mind. So just like in regular life, I guess.
In a very large crowd, isn't there also a chance of stampede, as we see in the movies?
There is a chance of that. And
because
so
we've seen it in a number of instances in nightclubs and theaters. And then there was that case during the Hajj in 1990 where over almost 1,500 people were killed in a stampede in Saudi Arabia.
Yeah, I looked a lot at the history of the Hajj because you have so many recent stampedes there. And it is really incredibly heartbreaking because what you see is that it's a question of physics. So the space is too small. People are jammed. There are too many people in the space. And then if one person trips, maybe they fall over something or whatever, then people behind them don't know that that has happened. So they keep pressing forward. And it creates this horrible, you know, literally a domino effect where people in the back don't know that they are literally, you know, suffocating people by pressing forward.
So you need a bottleneck, in effect. If there is plenty of access out of a space, you're less likely to see the stampede.
Absolutely. We know how to design buildings and spaces and stadiums so that there are not stampedes. The question is getting people to do it.
Well, how do we survive if we find ourselves in a situation like this where the crowd is pushing forward? Now, I want to get out too. There's only that narrow space. How do I survive that?
Well, it's hard. At that point, it's a little late in the game. I mean, stampedes are very tricky.
Can you slow them down?
You can if you have a communication device, if you can communicate to the crowd. But again, that's somebody who's in charge. That's not you. What I found was I talked to Keith Still, who's done a lot of consulting for the Saudis on helping them prevent stampedes. And he said that, well, you know, you hope you don't get in that situation. But if you do, you want to try to make your way to the side of the situation because there's less pressure there and then make your way towards the exit.
Now, when a disaster strikes, it usually strikes without warning. It takes a while for any kind of emergency personnel to respond. We have to become the emergency personnel, don't we?
Right. And that's what I think we've really got to get better at is thinking, you know, giving people a sense of responsibility because they're going to get it one way or the other. In a big disaster, it's going to be 3 to 5 days before the pros show up. California is really good at conveying this to people because they know if the big earthquake comes, you're on your own.
Is there earthquake education in Los Angeles?
There's a lot. California is way ahead of everybody else on this. And one of the cool things Governor Schwarzenegger did recently was he created a cabinet-level position for managing volunteers. I mean, that's remarkable. This is basically somebody at the table who represents regular schmucks, you know, and because he understood, he got sick of going to disaster scenes and seeing volunteers getting turned away, and he understands that this is a huge asset that we can't ignore the way we have been. That these are the most important people because they're always first on the scene.
There's a small town in California called Samoa where last year they had their first ever tsunami evacuation drill.
I'm so glad you asked me about that. Yeah.
How likely is it that there'll be a tsunami in Samoa, California?
Significant. I mean, well, compared to what, right? It's definitely in a tsunami inundation zone, and it's less likely than, you know, a million other things happening, but it's certainly possible. Much of California is in a tsunami inundation zone. And it was cool because I really enjoyed writing about a place where nothing bad had happened yet. And what they had done was one of the guys who worked with the National Weather Service was setting up a tsunami evacuation route. He thought that would be a good idea to put up some signs. But instead of just putting up the signs, like which is what normally happens if it happens at all, he decided to ask the people who live there where to put the signs. And then he decided, well, let's just have a drill. Let's have a tsunami drill, which had never happened in California, which is amazing. And so they told this town, okay, you know, on Monday night, we're going to set the siren off and everybody goes to high ground. And he didn't know if people would do it. And everybody, almost everybody came out, you know, women in wheelchairs, kids with their pets, you know, people brought their bags of stuff they would want to save. So they went through the whole process and they got up there in 10 minutes or so, which is exactly what they needed to do. And they were really into it. So it shows you that people are happy to take on this responsibility if they're properly motivated.
Well, tsunamis are unlike some disasters in that they give warnings beforehand to the point where animals often know about it way before anyone else.
Right. A lot of tsunamis, there's clear signs that something is wrong, like the sea will recede suddenly and act very strangely. So there's fish flopping around on the sand and so forth. And also anytime there's an earthquake, you should know to get to high ground if you're near water. But unfortunately, in many places, we've forgotten this lesson. So animals sometimes understand it better than we do.
Well, I remember when I was in school and we had those fire drills. In fact, I've had fire drills in throughout my working life as well. They've always just been nuisances. You're saying that we should pay more attention to them?
Yeah, well, I don't think that they're done very well. I think that if people explain to you that your brain becomes non-functioning in certain ways in a disaster, in a real fire, then maybe you'd be more likely to understand the importance of knowing how to get down the stairs. And also they should be made enjoyable. You know, I mean, I think there's no preparedness act that you should do, or almost none, that doesn't give you guaranteed benefits whether or not something happens. So I tell people, you know, if you're the boss of an office, you should say, okay, we're going to have a fire drill. It's absolutely mandatory. It's important that we do this. Here's why, because your brain doesn't work the same way in a disaster. And we're going to all meet at the Starbucks, and I'm going to buy, you know, coffee for everyone. And it'll be, you know, a nice little, you know, moment. So either way, they get something out of it.
My guest is Amanda Ripley of Time magazine. She's written a book called The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why. It is published by Crown. A small town like Samoa can pull off a tsunami drill. I can't imagine New York doing something along those lines. I mean, not tsunami, obviously, but we could have other kinds of disasters, couldn't we?
I think that's
and
certainly...
And we had a pretty bad one on 9/11.
Yeah, and I still get into arguments with, you know, with people. I used to live in New York, and I, after 9/11, felt like surely they were going to make fundamentally change the way fire drills are done here. And they, many people would argue they have, but...
Could lives have been saved if we understood better how we react on 9/11?
Yeah, you know, 50% of the people in the towers didn't know where the stairs were. And that was, those were difficult buildings to get out of. I tell a story in the book about Rick Rescorla, who was the head of security for Morgan Stanley, who understood that this needed to be handled totally differently. And he would hold these amazing mandatory surprise fire drills where people had to actually go down a number of floors on a regular basis. And everybody who got out that day was very grateful to Rick Rescorla.
But the rest of us have no idea. And is this something that somebody like Rick Rescorla has to organize, or is this something that our government should be working on? Most of the drills that I've had in my life have been silly ones. When I was a kid, I had to climb under my desk and roll into a ball in case of some kind of a nuclear attack. Now, I would have been fried in a fetal position as opposed to a sitting position, but we understood that was a pretty stupid thing that we were doing.
Right. I mean, the people in charge need to respect the public enough to level with them. And then I think people will rise to the occasion. One thing we know is that firefighters are very trusted compared to most other authority figures. So I think it would be good to get firefighters, because firefighters will explain to you exactly why you need to know this, because they've seen the effects of not knowing. I also think that, you know, there are lots of ways to do this that are much smarter.
Well, let's back up a bit. Okay, so I find myself in some kind of an emergency situation, whether it's a fire or whether I'm in a plane where the pilot says, "Hey, we're going down and we're going to hit the water." They tell you all this stuff before the plane takes off, and everybody reads the newspaper while it's happening because it is boring and we kind of know it, but it doesn't matter. I'm not 100% sure what I really have to do with that thing that I put around over my nose. But okay, does that really matter? Or is it more important for me to be psychologically prepared for a disaster?
Most of what you can do before things go wrong, and you should. Because once things go bad, it's sort of too late. There is evidence that people who read the silly safety briefing cards in planes have a better chance of survival. So they should be done better so that you're motivated to pay attention, you know, but they're afraid to talk about it, honestly, because they don't want to scare you on airlines. But certainly anything you can do to familiarize yourself with getting out of a structure will improve your performance, because you will be more confident that you can, you know, impact your survival.
I've always requested sitting in the emergency row in an airplane. That's because you get more leg room. And now they're charging extra for it.
That's right, yeah. And a new study just came out last week showing that sitting in the aisle and near an exit does, in fact, improve your odds of surviving a plane crash, which makes sense. I mean, however you can get out, the faster you get out, the better off you are.
Are flight attendants trained to take command in case of an accident?
Yeah.
Or are they likely to exhibit the same kinds of negative panic symptoms the rest of us are?
I've never found any evidence of a flight attendant freezing in a crash, which is really interesting. But remember, they go through regular, realistic training. So their brains are prepared for it in ways that ours are not. But they have, to answer your first question, they have learned that it really helps if the flight attendant is screaming at you to get off, and you respond very well. People move much faster.
So screaming is good. Saying, be calm, everything's okay, is actually having a negative effect. It just lulls us into this denial that you were talking about?
Well, I think it's a waste of time. If I could remove all the times somebody in charge tells you to be calm in case of disaster, I would happily save that years off of our lives. I mean, I think, you know, people generally will be calm. Now tell me something I need to know.
Do these sorts of things leave us with PTSD?
Most people, no. Most people recover very well from trauma, and we're just now beginning to look at that. You know, we always looked at the people who got PTSD, and now scientists are saying, well, let's look at the vast majority. What's different about them? People are very resilient, and the more resilient you are before the disaster, the better you'll recover. So, you know, we just can't prevent every disaster. So it's important to kind of improve your chances of bouncing back before things go wrong.
Well, that improvement is something that a number of listeners have called about. They want to know how we can prepare ourselves psychologically for any disaster that might hit.
Yeah, there's a lot of things that you can do, some of which are pretty straightforward, some of which are kind of surprising. For example, one that sounds kind of funny but is actually pretty effective is now taught to a lot of police officers, so anytime they have their guns drawn or they're in a high-speed pursuit, they're taught to do controlled breathing. They call it combat breathing. You know, it sounds much more impressive. But you basically breathe in for 4 counts and hold for 4 counts and release for 4 counts, just like yoga. And they find this is a way for your conscious mind to amp down, to sort of control the fear response that, if it's too strong, can be a big problem.
Because you really want to focus. Part of the problem is so many different things are happening and you're having to contend with them all. If you can just narrow things down to the important things.
There's a zone, you know. Some amount of stress is very helpful to you. But if it gets out of control, you start losing cognitive function.
There is the other side of this coin. A listener has written in, whoa, this radio show is making me nervous and my breath is short.
I know. I really struggle with that because the book, most of all, is hopeful. And that's how I experienced it. I mean, usually reality is not as scary as your imagination. And so what we need to understand is that regular people matter and luck is not as all important as we think.
But I suspect that that's the same sort of thing that we see on airplanes, where the flight attendant goes through that litany of things that we have to do in case of an emergency. You block it out to some degree because you don't want to have to think that that's actually going to happen.
I think that's right most of the time. But there are certainly many things that we do think about and worry about, and those are often the wrong things. But, you know, I think the more you know about it, just like anything, the more interesting and the less overwhelming and frightening it is.
Do you think that you will act better in an emergency as a result of having done this book?
I do. I mean,
and will
you know,
I have to write a book so that I can get to that point?
No, I mean, I think that the more you understand your brain, just like anything else, you realize how good it is at improving. I mean, it's incredible how, you know, people who meditate, certain parts of their brain are bigger, and those are the parts of the brain that would help you in a disaster.
So people who meditate will do very well in a disaster.
Well, I can't make you a promise, but I will say that I think it might help, yeah.
Amanda Ripley is a senior writer for Time magazine, and she has covered any number of disasters, Myanmar and in New Orleans, and it helped Time win 2 national magazine awards, in fact. She's written a book called The Unthinkable, Who Survives When Disaster Strikes and Why, published by Crown. Thank you so much for being with us today.
Thank you.
On tomorrow's show, Pulitzer Prize-winning journalist Chris Hedges on what we can learn from veterans of the Iraq War. Also, I'll talk to a soldier who's refusing redeployment to Iraq and has registered as a freshman at Brooklyn College. Graphic artist Gary Panter will be here, plus our latest underreported. The Leonard LoPage Show is produced by Blakeney Schick, Sarah English, and Scott Goldberg. Melissa Egan is the executive producer. And we had help today from Lawrence Holland, Veronica Shigiel, and contributing producer Virginia Doris. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard LoPate, your host. Thanks for listening. Thank you.